Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to episode 3 of the ADHD Science Podcast.
Hell yeah.
Yes. Now, how are you, Tess?
I'm all right. I'm very tired. I'm very stressed. I'm writing my EPQ production log right now. I have literally left it to the last minute. It's due on Tuesday.
Very much rolling like a daisy. But it's all right. We'll get there.
Sure we will.
We are, so we're going to be quite quick because you've got to get on with your work and I've got to get on with worrying about your work.
Nice.
So we're going to talk today to Adrian Murray, who is from the University of Edinburgh, and is going to talk about ADHD and anxiety, which is quite appropriate and topical.
Hell yeah.
Adrian is very passionate about the subject and has all sorts of thoughts about how we push forward kind of real-time research in ADHD. Is sort of really interesting about what both about the subject but also about how we go about researching people in their real lives rather than in some sort of laboratory situation. So
yep.
Good stuff. So without further ado, have you got any other ado on the agenda?
No further ado at all.
Oh, one thing. Please do let us know what you think and...
Yes, we need more feedback. Let us know what we're doing well and let us know what we're doing wrong.
Yes. So you can find me on Twitter, Max Davey. You can find ADHD UK, any of those places, and just let us know, as in any of those places, meaning Facebook or Twitter.
Do
or
not find
else.
Me.
Don't find Tess. and...
It's probably not hard.
Or go to the ADHD UK website where there's a feedback form. And poor old Anna has taken the trouble of making it, so we ought to use it.
Shout out to Anna.
Right, let's go.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so hello. Welcome to our episode for today of the ADHD UK Science Podcast. Hooray, I'm Max, this is Tess.
Hi.
And we're talking today to Asia Murray, reader in psychology at the University of Edinburgh. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you. Great to be here.
There you are. And we're going to talk about, we're going to use as a springboard a paper that you did about ADHD and anxiety and the relationship between the two things. So, Tess, do you want to start our kind of rough list of questions?
When you were doing this research, what was your initial question that you wanted to answer?
So I think the kind of starting point for our research with ADHD and anxiety is we know that it's quite common for people with ADHD to experience anxiety and also depression. So I think that's quite well known. But then the question is, like, why, basically? What are the mechanisms that link ADHD to anxiety and depression? And are there certain symptoms that are more important than others? And something else that I'm really interested in as well is, like, are there actually kind of like feedback loops as well? Like, does it work both ways? In terms of, like, if people develop like anxiety symptoms, does that then exacerbate their ADHD? So these are the kind of questions I was really interested in, because I think all of them have got quite important implications for like how you intervene and how you support people to sort of prevent the development of anxiety in the first place. And if it does happen, then how do you actually kind of, what's the best way to intervene to help with those symptoms?
And I was just wondering, it might be worth just teasing out some of the ways in which ADHD and anxiety could be linked. I mean, I suppose the first thing is that having ADHD is in itself, particularly in a typical world, anxiety provoking. I suppose that's the first one.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, a lot of the stuff that we've covered in previous episodes has pointed directly to that. I mean, it is stressful because the world's not built for ADHD people. Mm.
But then I suppose equally there's potentially genetic, you know, ADHD is often talked about as a genetic condition, but we don't really talk about the genetics of anxiety quite so much, and whether that, you know, you're not necessarily a geneticist by trade, but some kind of common origin of both is another thing that I think about sometimes as well.
Yeah. And I think there can be quite a lot of overlap, even if you look at the way that anxiety and ADHD are defined. You see symptoms like concentration issues and stuff like that appears in both diagnoses. So you also have to be a bit careful about making sure that, like, if you're finding an association, it's not just due to the fact that basically the same thing is mentioned in both domains.
Yeah, you're double counting in a way.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's no one way in which ADHD is related to anxiety. I think there's lots of different mechanisms. And I think Tess, like, is exactly right. It is very stressful to be, like, someone with ADHD in the world. And that can cause all sorts of, like, you know, issues with, like, self-esteem and lead to anxiety. And one of the other things that we're quite interested in, because we think it's, like, probably quite a good point for intervention, is emotion regulation as well. Because some of the difficulties associated with ADHD could sort of make it more difficult to, you know, like, moderate emotional reactions and to kind of essentially manage emotions in a way that makes it more of a risk for anxiety symptoms developing, basically.
So you say that there's lots and lots of different possible explanations for what causes these overlaps. Was there a specific one that you were more drawn to than the others as an explanation, or a more common one?
I think I'm personally quite interested in emotion regulation, because I think emotion regulation is something that you can teach as a skill. Whereas I think, unfortunately, like, some of the other things that are quite anxiety provoking for someone living with ADHD in the world, it's a bit more contingent on other people and, like, the way that society is structured. So I think one of the reasons I'm quite interested in emotion regulation is that it's the kind of thing where you can sort of teach strategies for regulating emotions. Like, there are certain strategies that are more adaptive than others. Like, if you have, like, a stressful situation, a bad way of dealing with that is to kind of, like, ruminate on it, keep thinking about it, and kind of end up in a sort of vicious cycle where you just feel worse and worse. Whereas strategies like kind of what you might call cognitive reappraisal, thinking about the situation a bit differently, reframing it, thinking about it more in positive terms, can be a good way to regulate emotions. It's not straightforward, though, because, like, I think ultimately people need to be quite flexible in the way that they use different strategies to regulate their emotions depending on the particular situation that they're in as well. So it's not like, oh, there's always one strategy that is the right strategy. It's more like you need to have a good repertoire of strategies and be able to use them in a way that is suited to the particular situation that you're in.
Yeah, and I would like to return to strategies. I think it's probably a really good way to return to sort of later on. But I suppose I want to hear about your research, what you did, how you measured and studied the kind of people with ADHD, and how you found out what the relationship between their ADHD symptoms and their anxiety was.
So we've done a few different studies in this domain, and we've kind of measured it in different ways. And it's quite interesting that we find something similar, like, basically irrespective of how we do it. So we sometimes will look at people with a diagnosis of ADHD, but also we kind of take the view that ADHD symptoms are sort of dimensional. Not to say that, like, necessarily everybody's a little bit ADHD, but just because somebody hasn't got a diagnosis doesn't mean that they might not be experiencing some level of ADHD symptoms. So one way that we approach it is to just use samples from the population, measure levels of ADHD symptoms, and look at how that relates to things like emotion regulation and anxiety and other factors that might be involved in that association. One thing that we do is we try to capture people's symptoms, like, in the course of their daily life. So a lot of these sort of questionnaire-based measures of symptoms, it's sort of like a snapshot. It's not really giving you how people are really functioning in the course of their daily life. So one of the things we do is we do smartphone-based data collection, where people do surveys just on their smartphone, so they get a little notification, and then that takes them to a little survey with a series of questions. It's just about, like, you know, how are you feeling now, what are you doing now, over the course of, like, you know, several days, a few times a day. And then we use that to get a better picture of how people are actually functioning in the course of their daily life, because we think that's much more reflective of how people actually experience symptoms, how they regulate their emotions, and how that links to their mental health symptoms, like anxiety.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So what did you find with the...
So one of the things, yeah, I mean, we definitely find that ADHD symptoms are related to anxiety. That's something that comes through in all our studies. We find, interestingly, also that anxiety can lead to a worsening of ADHD symptoms as well. So it's sort of going in both directions, which is quite interesting.
So that's what I was going to ask. How do you tell what the direction of relationship, how do you know that it's bidirectional, or that, do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Or that you're not just measuring the same thing in slightly different ways.
Yeah. I mean, it's not infallible, because we're typically using like what you would call observational data, so it's not from an experiment or a trial. But essentially, by collecting information multiple times over the course of someone's life, over their development, then we can use the fact that we've, I guess, like the temporality of it. Like we can see, if you look at ADHD symptoms, then what happens to the anxiety symptoms at a later time point and vice versa. So essentially, by having the multiple time points, we can use different statistical methods that help us to tease apart that directionality.
So it's staggered check-ins on ADHD and anxiety symptoms, which kind of helps you get a better look at how they interact.
Exactly. Yeah, you put it much better than I did. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I wouldn't have been able to put it like that if you hadn't talked about that.
So in a sense, what you're saying is that a certain amount of ADHD symptom at time X, at, you know, in January, might, and this is probably massive oversimplification, might be able to influence how much anxiety you're feeling in time, you know, in June, which in turn will then influence. Tess is just, I'm doing far too much for our audio listeners. I'm doing far too much hand movements, and Tess is blocking me because I'm interfering with your personal space, which I should not do. And then in December, that might then rebound and predict your ADHD symptoms again. So in a way, and I see this clinically, a vicious cycle of ADHD and anxiety symptoms.
So you're thinking more long-term. I was thinking more on a short-term.
Well, that's a good question.
Maybe if you're feeling like anxious in the morning, your ADHD symptoms will be worse later in the day. Which one was it more focused on?
So most of the work that we've done has been more longer term. But actually what you say, I think, is really important, because I think there's a lack of studies that look at that shorter term relation. I think that's really important to understand better, because I'm sure it's happening on a short term as well, like over the course of a day, not just over the course of like months or years.
Yeah, it's probably a lot harder to look at though, because that's a lot more surveys you need to do every day.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So that's where the smartphone-based data collection is quite useful, because we can do that in a short term. Yeah. It's just tricky sometimes, because it's obviously quite a big burden to, you know, answer surveys like multiple times a day. So sort of convincing people to do that is quite tricky, which I totally understand.
How are you feeling now? I'm busy. That's how I'm feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Now. It's like...
Are you feeling any better yet? No, I'm not.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's another important point as well. Like people might selectively not respond if they're feeling bad, so you might get like a biased picture of what's actually going on, because they're like, oh, I really don't feel like answering right now, and they don't, so you only get the times when they're feeling better or something.
But is that not a problem with this way of surveying people anyway? I mean, I'm not saying, you know, kind of makes it invalid, but is that a problem that you have to kind of deal with when you're looking at your data?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's probably just magnified on the shorter scale, because I think with these like longer term surveys, there's a certain time point that's quite fixed that people will do the survey, like they'll either come in or they'll get sent a link, and it's quite kind of, they're sort of like given reminders and stuff like that. And that's one time point in like a year. Whereas with like this smartphone based thing, because it's happening over like, you know, days and hours, there's a bit more opportunity for people to selectively respond.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot bigger burden over a shorter period of time. Yeah. People can't build it in quite as easily. Mm. Okay.
Can you cut this out of the edit? Did you already say what the results are? Because I think I mind blanked over it, but you might have not said.
Well, I think you said that there was a relationship between the two. So maybe if we cut this out, message to the editors. No, we don't edit it anymore. It's very odd.
Oh, I'm sorry, editors.
What if you make your next question? So what was the relationship?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Okay, I just didn't want to ask if you'd already...
No, because that's why you're here, Tess.
Yeah, okay. So what was the relationship that you found between the two variables?
So we find with ADHD and anxiety that it worked both ways. So ADHD symptoms led to more anxiety symptoms later. And then especially in later adolescence, anxiety also led to an exacerbation of ADHD symptoms after that. So yeah, this kind of working two ways thing confirms what Max said, he like saw clinically. We definitely see that in the data.
And how do you, I mean, it sort of makes sense that worsening ADHD, so just sort of from a common sense, practical perspective, it sort of makes sense that worsening ADHD would make you more stressed, because actually it would just make you function less well and more things would go wrong for you. So you would feel more out of control. So you would be stressed, and that would work in both the short and long term. But how does greater anxiety then make you have more ADHD symptoms, other than just make you a little bit more agitated, which isn't quite the, well, is it the same thing? I don't, you know what I mean? That's what I'm kind of struggling
with. I think that's a really good question. It was something that we weren't able to look at in the data that we had, because we didn't really have that information. So I think it would be really good to actually do like some more work and find out what the mechanisms are. But I sort of suspect it might be, like, say if you're worrying a lot, that's using up your attentional resources, your mind is on your worries. So that's going to manifest like in your behavior is seeming more sort of distracted, not being able to concentrate as well. I guess being like physiologically quite aroused could be manifesting as more hyperactivity as well, more sort of restlessness. That's what I imagine it might be. But as I say, like, it's kind of speculating because we didn't actually have that information with that data.
No, Tess, you go.
Okay. Do you think that because we know that sleep affects ADHD symptoms, because we looked at that.
We have, and we're going to go back to sleep.
We looked at that in another episode.
In a future episode, we're going to go back to sleep.
Okay, anyway.
We're not going to go to sleep. We're going to remain awake.
So we know that sleep has an effect on ADHD symptoms. Do you think that anxiety could be causing like issues with sleep that could be leading to worsening of the symptoms?
That is a really good point, actually. I'm sure that must be one of the mechanisms as well, because like you say, we know that sleep is related to ADHD symptoms. Anxiety is related to worse sleep, so it makes sense. Maybe we should do that as our next study. Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to do your work.
That's going straight in the CV.
Go up to Scotland and do some work experience.
Maybe. I do have work experience coming up, so.
It's a little far. sorry. What was I going to, oh, yes. I suppose I was just going to say, I taking Tess's point, absolutely, but the thing that you said about using up your mental reserves, and we do talk in clinic sometimes about mental batteries that people have, and that ADHD is something that makes tasks that for other people will hardly deplete your batteries at all, deplete yourself
processing
a lot
power.
More processing power. So actually anxiety is taking up a lot of your processing power. So that does make sense. Sorry, I've been fine all day, and suddenly now I'm nightmare.
Suddenly, when you've got to record, that's when it all. Yeah, that's when I'll catch it.
Shall we go? Well, I have a bit of a cough. Why don't we go to the next question?
What does this mean for people looking after ADHD people?
So, do you mean like clinicians, or like say parents of people with ADHD?
I think the question's more directed towards parents and carers, but I think both. A couple other times we've been talking about, I think both.
Okay. So I think from a sort of parents or carers point of view, I think it's good to understand that like having ADHD is associated with more difficulties with regulating emotions. So I think like if, you know, somebody is struggling to kind of like be calm and kind of deal with the stressful situations, I think it's important to understand where that's coming from and not to sort of like say, attribute blame or have like expectations that are not realistic in terms of emotion regulation. I think it's also just because it is so common that anxiety is associated with ADHD, I think it's also just something to kind of be aware of and watch out for, you know, look out for those symptoms. Because I think like as a parent, like you're in a good position to sort of be noticing that that's happening, and you know, maybe it's a case of like having conversations with your child and stuff like that and making them aware about these symptoms as well, so that, you know, I think sometimes it can get missed in ADHD as well, because there's sort of, I guess you could call it diagnostic overshadowing, because there's a lot of symptoms sort of like going on anyway, it might not get detected so easily as compared to someone who doesn't have ADHD. So yeah, I think having that awareness that it might be a thing is quite important.
Yeah, I feel really strongly about that actually. I think particularly maybe more in boys, but I'm not sure, but anxiety gets missed, and anxiety and ADHD is a really toxic combination. Often those are the boys who are lashing out and acting out most in school, because their negative emotions are just overwhelming them, and they're impulsive and you know they're getting excluded a lot, and we don't actively seek out their emotional state nearly enough.
No. There's that whole kind of thing where a lot of boys, because of the stigma surrounding like male emotions, will portray any, like, they will channel any negative emotion as anger.
Yeah.
And so if that is coming from a place of anxiety, that's not going to be detected nearly as much as it would in like women or people who are raised as women, because they're taught that that's okay to feel, rather than like boys who are quite often taught that that's not.
Yeah. And we're still not good, even though we had sort of decades of mental health awareness, we're not that good at that very simple message that the person who's misbehaving in class or the person who's, you know, angry also needs to be treated as somebody with emotions and as a potential mental, someone who might need help with their mental health as well.
Yeah, and it might be difficult to tune into that and to understand that it's anxiety as well from the person who's experienced it from their point of view. Like ADHD can sometimes be associated with difficulties in sort of like labelling emotions and identifying them. So they might not even really be very aware themselves of what's going on internally. But the point about boys and girls, I think, is a really important one actually, because I think it is quite different for boys and girls, because with girls, it's often the case that ADHD will get missed, and like anxiety or depression will get picked up, and it's only later where it's like, oh, actually the underlying root cause of all of this was really ADHD, it wasn't really anxiety, depression being the root cause. And then with boys, like you say, it's like a bit more potentially the other way around. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about how ADHD and anxiety overlap. How do you think ADHD and depression kind of react together?
It's quite a tricky question, because anxiety and depression very often co-occur with one another as well. Like, it's very common for someone to experience both at the same time. So I think there's some commonalities. I think that with depression, I think that we find that there's a link with emotion regulation as well. So that's one thing. But I think also similarly, just this like day-to-day and broader life challenges of having ADHD, and like, for example, having difficulty with like say school or work or like friendships or relationships, like that can really undermine a person's self-esteem and then lead to depression basically. So I think it's quite similar in terms of the mechanisms, but it's just like a slightly different reaction in the end.
I mean, there's also
I'm just thinking back to the flat batteries thing as well, that I mean, I know it's probably a little bit on the nose because one of the ways that people who are depressed talk about themselves is as flat, but I really think that there is something there about just, they are often thought of two sides of the same coin, anxiety and depression, but I think in a sense anxiety is the using, you know, the diversion of your mental resources elsewhere into loops of ultimately not very purposeful thoughts, and the depression is just the cognitive and emotional exhaustion.
Yeah, it's like that burnout that you get basically. Yeah.
Because they are kind of qualitatively different things, and I know that they
pause.
What
does that mean for the audience?
Qualitatively. Okay, cool.
Cognitively, so, they are qualitatively.
Okay,
come on.
So in the
break,
no, you're right. Thank you for Tess. That's why you're here. Another reason why you're here. So in terms of the brain and how it feels, so what I should really have said is subjectively. So how it feels to be anxious and how it feels to be depressed are different.
Yeah.
In the quality of how it feels, they co-occur so often that they're usually talked of in one breath. And I think the mechanisms underlying them are probably ultimately very similar, but they are two parts of the same process. They're two consequences of the same process in some ways.
And I think part of what you were saying also gets to the point about how anxiety can sort of lead to depression, because it sort of leads to that exhaustion, that like just complete feeling of like hopelessness and lethargy and stuff like that after, you know, feeling anxious for a while.
Yeah. Because anxiety generally, well, not always, but very often comes first, is the thing that people experience first. It's not a kind of unifying theory of mental health, but it just, I find it useful as a way of thinking about these things, just practically.
So
go on.
What does this mean for ADHD people themselves?
Good question. So I think, again, it's a similar point probably about sort of being aware about what symptoms might be experienced and what difficulties with emotion regulation might be possible, being aware of that, kind of trying to learn strategies for regulating emotions. So learning about what are the more adaptive strategies for dealing with negative emotions and what are the less adaptive strategies. Like, so for example, as I say, like it's not very adaptive to ruminate on something, to just think over something negative and just get into like a negative spiral of thinking. So it's about kind of like catching yourself doing that and having like, you know, a plan for if that happens, then I'll, you know, divert myself to like a more adaptive way of managing emotions. I think also like there needs to be a bit of self-compassion as well, because it is harder if you've got ADHD to do these things. And so I think it's like kind of just not being too hard on yourself, really. Because I think that's part of the risk of leading to anxiety and depression, is that, you know, potentially feeling like you're failing at something or whatever because your symptoms are creating these, like, you know, multiplying how difficult things are. So I think that's part of it as well, is just like being accepting of ADHD symptoms and the impact that that has, and not being too harsh on yourself, I think.
I suppose I was wondering about that as well. You've mentioned a couple of times effective and not effective strategies. Are you saying that there's sort of evidence that certain, or there's a set of strategies that people can access that have been, you know, shown to work, and there's others that aren't? Or are you just saying, what are you saying when you say that, and where can people get those strategies?
Yeah, so there's a certain set of strategies that are shown to be more helpful than others, and by more helpful, I mean that they're linked to better mental health, and less helpful, I mean they're linked to worse mental health. So, for example, trying to suppress a feeling, not kind of acknowledge it, just trying to make it disappear, is not helpful.
Really?
It's kind of counterintuitive, because you think that, you sort of think like, oh, if I ignore it and if I don't attend to it, then, you know, maybe that's a way of dealing with it. But actually, it's got this paradoxical effect. It's bad for your mental health to use that strategy too much.
No, I mean, we've been on a journey with that as a family, so yes, I agree.
And then on the other hand, something like kind of reframing a situation. So again, if something stressful happens, rather than kind of focusing on the negative and, you know, thinking, oh, this is an absolute catastrophe, think about, well, what is a different way of thinking about that situation that's more positive, and doesn't focus too much on like things that are going to make you feel bad, but more think about like a more kind of, either like if it's a way that you can solve a problem, or just a way that you can think about it differently that's more positively framed, I guess.
I think in a lot of conditions, especially where spiraling can easily occur,
yeah,
like in ADHD, depression and anxiety, taking yourself out of that situation and out of that spiral and just looking in, trying to, well, not necessarily to objectify, because that can kind of oversimplify it. And like, if you over-rationalize the way that you're feeling, you might beat yourself up for it even more, because you're like, why do I feel like this? This is so...
That's my worry, candidly.
Honestly, it's different for everyone. For some people, like I know for me, taking myself out of the situation, just taking a second just to myself to breathe, look at this, let's think about it, let's figure out what's actually going on here, and let's figure out how it works. But I know for some people that just doesn't work at all.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I completely couldn't agree more that for people for whom they work, those strategies are really effective. My worry about the recommendation of strategies is the guilt you get when they don't work, or they don't work for you, and the self-blame that you get. So, I mean, what, not disagreeing at all, but just if you can't find strategies for yourself that are working, it's not your fault. I think it's a really important message for people.
I think the other important thing to say is, like, it takes a lot of practice. These are not easy strategies to use. I mean, you do need to have a lot of patience and really, really be very, like, compassionate with yourself, because it's not easy at all.
And I think that's something that really gets missed in a lot of the self-help, mental health industry. I'll call it an industry because that's what it is. It doesn't capture, and the same is true of parenting advice, it doesn't capture that this is tough and hard and needs patience and, you know, and the ability to just to cope with failure and keep going.
Which is also difficult for some of the people who are struggling. Which is also more difficult
for people with ADHD. And things may get worse before they get better. And none of that makes it into the online videos or the, you know, 10 great tricks to improve your mental health. It's really, really hard to start with when you start that process of trying to get yourself out.
Sorry to take this on again, but I feel like if you did say that, it's going to get worse before it gets better, or like, this is really difficult, you need a lot of motivation, that could bring on that kind of sense of like, okay, well, that's not going to happen.
Well, quite right, exactly. That's in a
massive dilemma here, because you don't really know which way to go, because it could end badly for everyone in every situation.
But I suppose, sorry, we've kind of, please.
No, this is really interesting. Yeah, yeah.
But I suppose that's right. But I suppose that the message I get from that is that one message doesn't work for everyone, and you have to have conversations with people on an individual level, which is really difficult when you have overwhelming need and relatively few people who are specialists or who are, you know, able to offer some kind of service. But even also a kind of narrowing of mental health support that only to only be able to be given by someone who's super specialist, rather than just be a conversation. I don't know what I'm saying here, really.
I think they should teach.
There's real dilemmas and difficulties here with how we talk about it.
I think they should teach more. This is a one single statement. I'm not going to say anything more about it. I think they should teach more about this in PSHE.
Oh, yeah. Well,
a lot more.
Completely.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. And from, like, you know, earlier as well, because these are skills that take a long time to master. So, you know, I think the other thing that you made me think of as well is about the kind of, you needing a lot of motivation to do these things. And I think sometimes these sorts of interventions can be a bit dry, a bit boring, a bit kind of like a bit of a drag. So I really think that, like, for people who are providing these interventions, they really need to make them more exciting and more interesting. And, like, you know, there's a lot of buzz around kind of gamification. So, like, for example, mental health, digital health tools that have got some gamification in it, where you can get like points for completing exercises and stuff like that. I think that sort of stuff can help to make it a bit less of a drag. But I think if you just assume that if you just give people like, here's a list of exercises to do, go away and practice emotion regulation, it's quite a lot to ask of people to kind of like self-motivate to do that.
Yeah, and it sets them up for guilt and failure.
Yeah, exactly.
That was my worry. Just small plug that we are planning in the next few weeks to have something up on the ADHD UK website of strategies, but not one strategy that's going to work for everyone. Strategies which are kind of chosen by our members, you know, people who we work with, or and upvoted or downvoted according to people who visit the website, and potentially, and we hope, different strategies for different age groups, genders, different, you know, groups who might need a different set of strategies. So that's something that we've been talking about for a long time in the charity, and we're finally at the point of being able to make the IT work. So hopefully that will work in the next few weeks. I'll try and put a link in the back in the show notes.
The other thing I wanted to mention as well is one reason why these interventions are quite difficult is there's a lack of co-production with people who have ADHD. So they're being designed by people who don't necessarily understand, like, what it's like to be using them. So I think, are these going to be sort of like crowdsourced from people with ADHD? Yeah, that's so needed, I think.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it goes. maybe we may get some odd odd results and odd things.
You're going to need someone to go through this and make sure that people aren't putting random stuff.
Well, I just wonder, if people might put some cheeky stuff in there.
You're opening up a forum to the entire internet. It's not going to go well.
Maybe some curation needed.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. So we'll get a Boaty McBoatface kind of situation. Is that what you're going for? Yeah, maybe. We'll see. But yeah, that's the idea. And it's sort of democratizing though, in a way. Although, as you rightly say, Tess, there may be pitfalls in that.
But God, I thought you said pitfalls.
Pitfall. Well, my pitfall is a strategy for my ADHD. Interesting strategy.
Well, pet therapy, no? That's a thing.
Dogs are great for ADHD.
I'm talking like Mr. Worldwide, Mr. 305, again.
What, Pitbull the...
Yeah, Pitbull.
The rapper.
Pitbull.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Ignore me.
I'm not aware of his output. I know you've got his picture on your wall, ironically.
I don't have it.
You do.
It was a properly outed there.
Kind of swoony kind of thing.
No, oh please.
You have got, you have got his picture on your wall. I'm like, who the hell is this guy?
No, because
very not Tess's, not Tess's situation.
One of my mates got me a card that said, you're my Mr. Worldwide. And I was like, wow, that's so sweet. So I hung up it on my wall.
Didn't know Tess was a Pitbull fan. There you are.
Okay, completely off track. Sorry about that.
Go back track.
Breaking news.
Sorry?
Breaking news.
Breaking news, yeah. Exactly. What? Go on then, Tess. You wrap us up.
Okay.
Because we're getting distracted.
So, what's your next question?
Oh, next question. I think that our next question is going to focus on how do we translate this into interventions that are actually effective for people and actually usable and not completely dry and boring. So at the moment we're collecting data from adolescents with ADHD using the smartphone-based methodology, and we think that that will give us a better sense of like how people are functioning in the course of their daily life. So it's a bit more kind of like valid, and we think that will give us more of an idea about, you know, targets in people's actual daily lives, how they're actually functioning, as compared to like the more traditional questionnaire design where people just, you know, fill in something, paper and pencil online or something, and it's just like a list of symptoms and risk factors and things like that. So that's the kind of direction that we're going in now, because I think there's a bit of a difficulty with like the interventions that there are at the moment. They don't necessarily generalize very well to people's daily lives. So people might learn some skills, but then it's more difficult to actually take those skills and actually apply them in the course of your daily life. It's quite a different matter to do like a sort of exercise and, let's say, again, emotion regulation as an example, versus actually take that into your daily life and apply it. So I think our focus next is like, well, how do we make that translation effectively so that people can actually apply this in their daily lives?
I think that's really exciting because it's like it's the translation, it kind of bridges the gap between what we know we ought to be doing as ADHD people. We know we ought to be using these strategies and using them. Actually,
big jump.
Yeah, exactly. It is. Yeah, it's a big gap to bridge, I think. Yeah,
because we're so good as doctors or psychologists or whatever as just sort of telling people, oh well, have you tried this, have you tried that, etc. And it just makes us feel better that we've given some advice, but actually if it's not actually applicable in people's everyday lives, you know, when they're feeling at their most stress, when they're in the supermarket, when they're thinking about whether to have a drink or whatever, those, you know, take drugs or whatever, it's useless if you're just kind of giving it out and then it's sort of sitting there on the shelf.
Life is so much more complicated, isn't it, than, you know, what we imagine when we give out this sort of advice.
Yeah. I mean, I feel quite strongly about it that we very often just generally give advice to kind of make ourselves feel better.
People, like, this is such like a, well, that's so deep, but like...
Go on.
Anyway.
I'm going to go and get...
I feel like...
I'm going to go and get George.
Okay.
You carry on.
I feel like people massively underestimate how different, like, people are. And I know that's such, like, a broad statement, but...
I think we're very, like, what we do is we sort of assume that other people are like us, so we sort of, like, project how we are onto other people, and just, I think you're exactly right, we completely underestimate how different other people are, not just from each other, but from us as well, so... When we're thinking about what's going on in terms of like other people's brains, like we're just using ourselves as a model, but that's not accurate because everybody is so different in terms of how they're wired.
A lot of the advice that you'll get will be, this is what worked for me, rather than what kind of you're doing, which is, this is what worked for, like, rather what we're like the, oh my God, I'm ruining this podcast. I'm so sorry. It's less of a, this is what worked for me, and more of a, this is what worked for this group of people.
Yeah, but that can...
Which is, it's still might not be helpful because you might not be, like, fit in with the same things that have happened to that group of people, but it's a lot more helpful than just, this is what helped me.
But what you have is the potential to, not necessarily, because people talk about subgrouping ADHD and splitting it into subgroups and subdivisions of ADHD. I'm not sure I'm a big fan of that.
You don't need to sort out the differences in ADHD by creating more boxes to put people into.
That's
going to make more problems.
That's my feeling. But what you could do is get to the point where you can take the strategies that are useful for all people with ADHD to an extent and pick for you, given your age, gender, particular situation, how anxious you are, you know, what kind of job you have, how much sleep you get, I don't know, various personal variables, what strategies are likely to work for you. So you can have that personalization without having to
lots
of different categories, which I think...
Because people get so attached to the categories as well, and they sort of reify them, and it causes all sorts of issues, I think, you know, just...
I've never heard of this.
Well, do you want to bring sort of...
The categories, in terms of the categories.
The categories and all of the kind of splitting that goes on.
Well, I mean, I guess the main distinction that's made is between, like, inattentive versus hyperactive impulsive. And then so you'll have these two main areas of, like, difficulties, and then you'll have people who have both. That's the main distinction that's made, typically. But then there's also sort of interest in sort of subgrouping in other ways as well. But that, like, the sort of diagnostic system would make those main distinctions.
Yeah, I think that's right. And then people would be subtyping as, autism and ADHD as a combined condition, and then there will be subtypes of ADHD with this and ADHD with that. And I mean, I think at one point somebody asked me, which of the five types of ADHD have I got? And I'm like, well, I don't know. That's a helpful way.
Yeah.
But I had to be, you know, nice and say I've got a combined type.
I mean, putting things into boxes make it a lot easier for people to understand.
Yeah, I mean, these boxes...
Like, people do it with personalities. I know you hate the MTBI test.
Oh, really?
But some people really love them because it helps them really simplify something that's so, so complicated.
I'm FSG6. No, that's not one of them. I don't know.
I think it can have some benefits because it can help with communication, and it can help, having a label can sometimes help people make sense of their experiences. But I just think you need to not believe in them too much and take it too far, because they do have the limitations. They are kind of arbitrary to some extent. And the other thing that you just made me think of as well is, like, I think probably more than subtyping, the kind of direction of travel at the moment is going to be much more like individual level personalization. And so, again, like, the sort of smartphone based data collection is quite good in terms of that potential, because you can get quite detailed profiles on people's symptoms, triggers, you know, what sort of stressors might precede what symptoms and stuff like that. So that helps you learn much more like what might work for an individual person, as opposed to kind of relying on what works on average for people with ADHD. So I think that's quite an exciting direction as well, but it's still kind of in its infancy at the moment. So I have to see where that goes.
It's an absolute treasure trove of data, the smartphone and that, all of that kind of, you know, that kind of way of gathering data. You can get so much more.
We are learning incredible. About that. It's called hypertextuality.
Hypertextuality.
It's called hypertextuality.
Should you be learning about that sort of thing in school? I disapprove.
I've actually not heard that term before. So what does hypertextuality mean then?
It's just, it just refers to the sheer amount of information that is on the internet at just the click of a button to anyone who has access at all.
It's a really good word. I like it a lot.
Yeah, we're learning about that in sociology now. Nice. Miss, my teacher will be so proud of me.
Reference to sociology at A level. Hooray, wonderful. Okay, I think before Tess and I entirely lose the subject and start talking about something completely
different.
I had
two coffees before we recorded
this. Did you?
Yeah.
That explains a lot. we want to thank you very much, Aisha, for coming and good best of luck with all of your work. And if you want to come back on and have a chat, well, maybe we can get you to one of our events in the future. I'd be very, very, very delighted to see you. Well, the charity
can I
is...
come?
Yeah, okay.
Guys, we're doing events.
Tess is going to start talking about merch in a minute, if you're not careful. All right, well, thank you very much. We'll leave it there. And I suppose if people want to contact you and ask you about your stuff, are you on kind of social media and so forth?
Yes, I'm on Twitter. Should we do links? Will there be I can do my handle and stuff like that? Yeah, but you can find me on Twitter, or my email address at University of Edinburgh as well is online as well. So, yeah.
You went massively hard to find, like some of the people we've been trying to track down. Wonderful. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Right. So that was Aisha.
Hell yeah.
That's your new thing. That you just do. But...
I don't think hell yeah could be a trademark catchphrase. I'm pretty sure it's been used before.
Pretty much what you do when I say things at the moment.
It's just my default response.
Very tired. I just wanted, before we go, to thank a couple of people. Well, actually, let's just talk about Anna this time. We'll talk about John next time. Anna is the business manager for ADHD UK and has basically helped us to not do all the bits of having a podcast that we're not good at. Like publicising it and organising the kind of all the admin stuff, and she's been amazing. Nice. She's been so helpful. So Anna, thank you very much for all your work on this series. I know you won't be around for the next series, but we will miss you then.
What?
a different response from Tess. Wonderful. All right. Anyway, please let us know what you think, as we said before, and we will see you next week.
Well, we will discuss John during the outro. Guys, fingers crossed, it's going to happen.
All right. Bye.
Bye.